Բարև ձեզ, Աննես Մարեն է, բարի գալուստ Հայաստան, որտեղ են կերասեր և հյուրընկալ մարդիկ են ապրում։ Ցանկացած մարդ մեզ համար, ով կգա մեր երկիր և կայցելի, միշտ ուրախալի է ընդունել և ճանապարհել։ Stay tuned!
Hello, and thank you for tuning in. You're listening to Travel Tales from Beyond the Brochure, a podcast looking at unfamiliar places across the world and aspects of travelling you may never have thought of. I'm your host, the barefoot backpacker, a middle-aged Denby with a passion for offbeat travel, history, culture, and the whys behind travel itself. So join with me as we venture beyond the brochure. Hello. Further to my last episode, I now have my PIN, so everything is back to normal, and I've done and updated everything I need to do regarding my upcoming trips, save Italian trains, which is a whole thing in itself, and I have just about memorised my new card number, but not quite. I've bought a couple of other things online with it, including a pair of funky dungarees from Run and Fly that resemble the carpet from a 1990s bowling alley or arcade machine centre, which is almost as on brand as the dungarees I'm having custom made by a lady in Lanarkshire, I don't recall which of the Lanarkshires, which are daisy themed, obviously. I've had those daisy dungs on my hit list for over a year now, but I've only just got round to asking the question. I am exactly the sort of person who would order bespoke clothing because a combination of my size, my personal identity, and my demographic. I'm pretty unique, you know? Indeed, this is evident in other ways. Over Easter, I had an email from the Avon organisation about a potential media interview. Now, Avon are the Asexual Visibility and Education Network, and act as the de facto central organisation and resource library for all things asexuality. And they'd been approached by a national newspaper in the UK who wanted to run an article on asexuality, but from the point of view of an older, more professional ace, rather than the typical representation of asexuals being younger millennial and Gen Z. And Avon thought of me. Not going to lie, it's not a saturated market. I don't know when it's going to go live, but when it does, I'll let you know. The main downside to it is the media in question, but I had a chat with my therapist about this, and I do feel a bit more comfortable around it, even if she doesn't. It's with the Daily Telegraph, which is not a newspaper with readership that overlaps with my audience. It certainly isn't in the same market niche as a non-binary budget barefoot backpacker with purple hair would normally operate in, but let's be honest, I am aware of my privilege, and I'm aware too that I can move in those circles. Uncomfortably. But I just have to remember that their audience are, I mean, I would say people like my mother, but we've already established canonically on this pod that my mother reads the Daily Mail, and not the Daily Express, or the Daily Telegraph. For some reason, I don't know why she reads the Daily Mail. Rather, we're dealing with an audience made up of people that I used to go to secondary school with, and yes, I disliked them at the time, but that's just because we were all teenagers and not because of any fundamental rift in our ideologies. Indeed, one of my online friends now, who I used to go to primary school with, she always thought of me as Tory boy, which, in hindsight, was kind of embarrassing in Liverpool, Bolton, sort of place that even at the height of Margaret Thatcher, the Conservatives were in danger of losing their election deposit. But that's a tale for another podcast. For now, just be aware that everybody masks. Everyone can lead different lives with different people, and sometimes it's useful to use privilege for the advantage of the underrepresented, even if it's only small steps, and doing so means you can't be your whole self. As an aside, the conversations I've been having have brought home just how much more comfortable and self-validating it is for me to use they-them pronouns and go by the name of Nell rather than my birth name. Even if I'm not uncomfortable using my birth name, it's not a dead name, it's simply a name I use in certain circumstances. One of their circumstances, by the way, and this is by administration rather than by choice, is coming up in early May. I don't know how many of you know this, but I'm vaguely political. I mean, it's clear from my podcast episodes and my blog website that I have a strong interest in political issues. But you may not know I'm actually a card-carrying member of a political party here in the UK. I say card-carrying, it's all online, I don't have a card. It shouldn't be hard to guess which one. It's not the SNP, on the grounds that I live in Salford, despite what the outro to my podcast says. I must change that one day. Anyway, there are local elections this year on the first Thursday in May, and the aim of the party is to stand in every local ward. For those outside the UK, a ward is the lowest level of political representation in the UK, if you don't count parishes, and let's be honest, pretty much no one else does. Each local authority, district, borough, unitary authority, metropolitan borough, London borough, whatever, is divided into wards, which elect between one and three councillors to the local authority council. It's really very hyper-local, and the sort of thing you can be elected to if you get 500 votes. In some parts of the country, you even have uncontested elections, when the number of candidates is not more than the number of posts to elect. The political party I'm a member of is not one of the big two parties in England, and their aim seems to be simply to stand in every local council ward, not because they think they'll win, indeed they actively don't plan to, but more to promote that they exist as a party and to ensure that a democratic election can take place, in the sense that all views are represented and people have as much opportunity to register their choice as possible. I have been selected as a candidate in one of the wards in my local authority. By selected, what I actually mean is my flatmate said I'd be a potential candidate and the party jumped at the chance. It required me saying, yeah, all right, and then filling in a series of forms for admin reasons, all of which using the name I'm registered on the electoral roll with rather than the name I actually use. This does have the advantage of making me quite hard to find with online searches, albeit this is before any article about asexuality in the Telegraph is released, which will also be using my legal name. Not that it matters. I have as much chance of winning as Aston Villa have of winning the English Premier Football League this season, in that it's theoretically and mathematically easy, just we live in the real world, not a mathematical model. And we're not actively campaigning. I'm literally just what they call a paper candidate. You know, there to be, well, you know, there, not to be actively seeking to win. The ward in question is a rarity. It's a Conservative area in a very Labour borough. It's also very Jewish, which may well be related. Hope we don't get elected. That'd be embarrassing and awkward. I'm just also glad that so very relatively few people listen to this pod and I can retrospectively edit it and upload a new version just in case it does. I didn't say anything. No one's heard me say anything. Can't prove anything. I don't think there's any other housekeeping or life updates to mention. There will be in my next episode, as one of my good travel Twitter and podcasting buddies, Amanda Kendall, of the Not a Ballerina blog and Thoughtful Travel podcast, and who has appeared on this podcast more than anyone else, has just arrived in Manchester, and we'll be meeting up and hopefully, maybe even doing some podding together. But as of now, she's sleeping off jet lag and I'm in a pub drinking beer from Norway that tastes like a farm. I've no idea what my next episode will be on, but in principle, that'll be my 101st actual podcast episode, including Twitter Space conversations, but excluding special and extra episodes, so I guess I ought to do something to acknowledge the centenary. But, as of this episode, travel. When we last left our grumpy, snot-filled and cheese-overdosed fake Tory backpacker, they had just arrived in their 90th country, Armenia, for a few days exploring another ex-Soviet republic. I arrived in Yerevan in the cold, slightly wintry pre-sunrise air. What little light had arrived on my journey in the nautical twilight, which was almost exclusively a combination of the train lights and external street lighting, revealed a semi-industrial landscape covered in a small blanket of snow. My bare toes expressed a relief that under the cabin bench were a pair of closed shoes, albeit ones bought cheaply and now showing their lack of value and lasting coherence. Yerevan station itself was small, but what it lacked in size it made up for in overbearing. Marble floors, huge ceilings, intricate decor, it reminded me more of the central libraries in UK cities. There wasn't a lot physically there. It was all space and little filler. And what there was closed because it was 7 a.m. and some way south of the city centre. A couple of taxi drivers came up to me and asked if I wanted a ride. The city centre was, what, 3-4 kilometres away, maybe? But honestly, time was not a problem. And if I wanted to get to my hostel in time to check in, which was 2 p.m, I could. I mean, if there'd been a train going back to Tbilisi, I could probably have crossed the border again in the time that I had. But not back, obviously. As I say, time was not a problem. The one thing Yerevan railway station did not have was Wi-Fi, which meant I had no access to maps. While I'd screenshotted the route from Google Maps, yet again this was at too high a level to be actually useful, with regards to road names and anything else, other than a vague direction and a sense of junction. Consequently, I had no concept of where I was. I knew which exit I'd taken from the train and thus what direction I was facing in relation to what direction I'd arrived. I knew too that Yerevan was south of Tbilisi, therefore it made sense to walk out to the station and turn right, essentially back the way I'd come, in order to get into the city. Listener, you may not be surprised to know, this was the wrong way. In fact, it was completely the opposite way. Because I don't know what that train did, but it didn't do what would have been logical, maybe. But also because I have very bad spatial awareness. Fortunately, I realised this, but not until two main crossroads away from the station when I managed to pick up Wi-Fi from a nearby pharmacist. Spoiler, this would not be the first time this happened in Yerevan. Not that it was a bad thing, really. It was still darkish, and time was, as I say, not one of my problems. I'm going to repeat that many times. Plus, it enabled me to find a cash point and to draw out some money. I wasn't sure how much to withdraw, but I figured it made sense to cover myself to paying cash for the tours I'd booked which hadn't been confirmed. If they were cancelled, bonus, more beer money. I only wanted to use my card once. Just so as you know, I can follow maps, but that requires me having a starting point. Honestly. And yes, Scottish Hiking Twitter, I can see your knowingly raised eyebrows from here. By the time I walked past the station again, it was light enough to me to get a sense of my surroundings. The station is quite a large building, takes up one side of a public square that's filled with grass pockets and a large statue. This is the Sasunti David statue, a 6.5 metre sculpture standing on a plinth of similar height. David of Sassoon, the English translation, is the hero of a whole cycle of Armenian folklore, the Daredevils of Sassoon, that until I wrote out this podcast, I was genuinely unaware of. It's far too long and intricate for me to go into any great detail on this pod, especially as I'm coming into it completely cold, unlike the pod I did on myths and legends a while ago, because I absolutely do have more of a handle on Irish tales. But as far as I can tell, it involves an unwanted marriage, invasions of a Christian nation by Arabs, a magical lightning sword, a mythical divine warhorse, familial strife, and portents of child revenge, a continual symbolic usage of the number 40, and an awful lot of sex. Sassoon, or Sassun, incidentally, is now in Turkey, in the Far East, near the city of Van. This is a common theme in Armenia, and it's not the last you'll hear about that particular country. But back to contemporary Yerevan. Now I was actually going the right way, I was able to wander slowly and get a feel for the city. This included stopping for an hour by an important road junction a mile or so south of the centre to use Wi-Fi from a nearby pizzeria, closed because who the feck has pizza at 9 a.m, to catch up on stuff I'd missed, upload my adventures to Instagram because I'm such an influencer, and other unimportant pieces of admin. But interestingly, not download new maps of the city, because mine were just fine, honestly. It also included doing the same thing in a bakateria just north of the centre, where I had a chocolate and Nutella croissant and a chocolate brownie. Very slowly. On my way, I passed by what amounts to the central square of Yerevan, Republic Square. It's one of those places that carries a must-see vibe, but equally doesn't take very long to see. Pretty much like every single main central square in cities around the world, really, except Times Square in New York, because that place really is unassuming and overrated. What you can see from Republic Square is a myriad of well-structured and imposing buildings, hosting things like government ministries and large museums. It's somewhat more impressive than Liberty Square in Tbilisi, and it feels quite a bit bigger than that too, and I didn't really have the sense that Baku had an equivalent location at all. My aim for this walk had been to reach the Mother Armenia statue, which stands on a cliff overlooking the city. If that sounds familiar to podcast listeners, it is. Wikipedia tells me that the other mother statue is in Kyiv in Ukraine, and I'm sure I've been to it given where it is in the city, but I can't currently bring it to mind. However, on my first day in Yerevan, with quite a full, bulky and awkward, if not specifically heavy, backpack, and no map, my attempt was thwarted by the main ring road and a series of nearby roads not having pavements, and some semi-feral dogs on the derelict hillside directly underneath it. And the knowledge that I probably had at least one day here to explore anyway. A very slow meander around the city centre, along tree-lined boulevards with Soviet-era tenement blocks, and the occasional linear park that acted as a kind of green ring around the city, past the outdoor ice rink put up for the winter season, and I stopped to take pictures of several odd statues and pieces of art, including one that was nothing more than a mirror proclaiming the beauty of your well-being and may have been possibly an advert for a Swedish cosmetic company. It all ended with me going to my hostel, the Envoy Hostel, quite central, close to some craft beer places, and hoping that I could check in. It was midday. It was also very much off-season, so they were more than happy to allow this. I was also able to get some laundry done, so I no longer had to wear second-use socks and underwear. You may be pleased to know, well, Laura may be pleased to know, given our adventures in Philippines, past me had booked themselves into a private room with private bathroom. Definitely pushing the boat out there, methinks. But then by staying there, I could get money off the tours that they did. This would have been an advantage, had they been offering any. However, as it turned out, two of the three tours I'd requested, one around Soviet Yerevan, the other a trip into the country to visit one of the large lakes and its surrounds, weren't running, because I was the only person who have booked onto either, because it's the middle of winter and nobody's here. The other tour, to monasteries and a canyon in the north of the country and ending back in Tbilisi, was running, and I'll talk about that later, but to be honest, that was the only one of the three that was actually important for me to do anyway, for logistical reasons, and I was kind of half expecting the other two to be cancelled anyway, so it wasn't much of an issue. That said, the Soviet Yerevan tour would have been something right up my street, and visited a series of places I wouldn't have the backstory for by going alone, and also they were quite awkward to get to. So if I ever come back to Yerevan, it gives me something to plan to do. Now, you may recall in my last episode, I mentioned on the train to Yerevan, I'd listened to an episode of Amanda Kendall's Thoughtful Travel Pod, which is more than she listens to my pod, where she chatted with a chap from Armenia who'd helped out in building a hostel's brand and in expanding it from Yerevan to Tbilisi and into Cambodia. Yet at no point in the episode do I recall him mentioning the name of the hostel in question. In the bathroom of my room was a sticker advertising the Tbilisi hostel and mentioning Cambodia. Was this a coincidence? Listener, it clearly was not a coincidence. I don't know why I bother building tension. This is a travel podcast, not an episode of The X Factor. On the tour I did do on my last day in the country, back up to Tbilisi, I mentioned that pod episode to our guide, Marina. You heard her in the intro to the pod. And she said, yes, she listened to it as well. And yes, George Babayan, the guest in question, did indeed work at Envoy Hostels and was helping out in expanding the brand elsewhere. Sadly, he left a few years back, so I never got to meet him. The hostel room I was in, by the way, was a perfectly comfortable and functional room. Single bed, desk with chair, window onto the street, bathroom with sink, toilet and shower. It vibed like a student room in halls. Albeit when I was in halls, we didn't have building-wide Wi-Fi, though that was at the mercy of the occasional power cut, one of which was when I was supposed to be on a call with my VA. So I had to sit entirely on the windowsill, picking up a very faint Wi-Fi signal from the pharmacist and beauty salon across the road. In our student halls, we also didn't have our own bathrooms. But then, that was the early 1990s, and life was very different then. Private bathroom would have been posh. It is possible I still travel with a student mindset. Age is a weird thing. My mother had been married 21 years by now, and that was her second marriage. Owing to it being out of season, and therefore having 2 days' worth of time to fill, I decided my first full day in Yerevan would be, in lieu of the Soviet history tour not taking place, seeing something of Soviet history for myself. And the best place for that would be up above the city at the Mother Armenia statue. Given the previous day's failure and a suggestion from Google Maps that I venture a couple of miles out of my way, which seemed weird, I asked at reception the best way of getting there. Oh, go up the Cascades, there's a footpath, said the member of staff on duty. Followed by, I know that route, I live up that way. So, there you have it. Absolute local knowledge. I'd seen mention of the Cascades on maps, but didn't know anything about it. Them, whatever nebulous geographic locations pronouns are. It turns out that what they are odd, stroke weird. The short explanation is that they're a flight of steps up a hill that runs over the top of a cultural museum and arts complex. The long answer is that they're an outdoor art installation in itself. The Cascades are, Wikipedia calls it Yerevan Cascade singular, but the Wikipedia article currently reads like Fancroft, a series of stairways climbing up a hill. The trek up and down covers at least 550 stairs. I was actually counting them on my descent, but I didn't stop until I'd taken a few. It'd make a good keep fit session. Rocky would have been unbeatable. I say that suggests none of his opponents hailed from Yerevan, but until the early 2000s it wasn't really much to write home about anyway, despite being proposed as early as 1920s. Better late than never, I guess. In fact, it's not even finished yet. The project is designed to go from city level all the way up to Victory Park, 400 metres or so up the hill, and around 100 metres higher than it currently gets. But the last section is still a construction site, and the current diversionary route is slightly oblique, not signposted, going up a residential back street and then a flight of stairs protected by a security guard's hood that looks for all the world like it's going to some works unit. I flitted around nearby suburbia to avoid going up it because I didn't know, but going down, it was actually blindingly obvious that I should. The cascade itself is more than just a flight of stairs, though. At the bottom of them is a small park area filled with decidedly odd sculptures. These include a curvy anthropomorphic cat, a wickerwork teapot, a leaping deer, and something that I assume is a puffy dandelion but looks not unlike a COVID virion. I did notice many of the sculptures whose works here are British. I don't know what that says, except that we're a country that likes weird sculptures, I guess. Behind the stairs, built into the hill, is a large arts centre which hosts exhibitions, though on my visit it was only open to the public later in the week, I think Thursday to Sunday, so I didn't get a chance to go inside. The art creeps up the stairway, but the main thing to look at when you're climbing isn't the public art, it's actually the natural art. The stairway looks out over the city towards the southwest, but it's not the city that catches your eye. Rather, it's the mountain range beyond. Several snow-capped peaks stand against the clear blue sky. The highest of them is Mount Ararat. Yes, that Mount Ararat, which, by the way, is not to be confused with Mount Aragats in the north of the country, which we'll mention in passing later. Mount Ararat, the alleged resting place of Noah's Ark, stands some 5,100 metres tall and is usually covered with snow and ice. Indeed, there's a genuine ice cap around the summit, to the extent that it's quite difficult to climb, and not just because it's in a, quote, sensitive border area, unquote. Images of Mount Ararat appear, or have appeared in the past, on Armenian stamps, Armenian currencies, and many logos, crests and coat of arms of Armenian businesses, sports teams, etc. Even before I arrived, I'd known it was a symbol of the city, but I didn't realise quite how easy it was to see. Quite often such symbols are, yeah, you can just make it out in the distance, are, or, ah, we've built things in the way now. But this was literally as clear as day. Even though it's in Turkey. Or at least it is now. We'll come on to that later. But suffice to say, the mountain is incredibly fundamental to Armenian culture and heritage in a kind of lost nostalgic homeland way. Mount Ararat is visibly central all the way up the ascent of the Cascades, to the extent that I wonder if that was part of the plan. At the top, on a flat and wide patio area, 50 metre tall column that screams communist as soon as you see it. This is the 50th anniversary of Soviet Armenia Monument, which, I mean, the name kind of gives away its origin as well as its age. The late 1960s was a time for architecture of all kinds, but it's basically a narrow cuboid of stone bricks with what looks like a 50-metre tall chess piece on top. I'm sure it's symbolic of something. The blogger Rhinus Fischer describes it as a spike of wheat representing the Tree of Life. I have no idea. On my visit, also, the ground was quite slushy with the remains of snow. This and nearby Victory Park were the first visible reminders on my trip that this was actually winter in the mountains. The view from here over the city highlighted also the Soviet nature of much of the general architecture too. Unlike Baku and Tbilisi, Yerevan feels quite uniform. I'll mention more about this shortly. The other thing to note about the location was a vague indifference to health and safety. That's quite a small wall that's easily accessed. That's quite a big drop over the other side. Over the road from the monument is Victory Park, which is, as evidenced by the name alone, quite Soviet in layout and decor. Even down to the fence that doesn't stop you falling off the cliff edge. Again, it's not particularly tall. It wouldn't stop you if you were determined, stupid, or, you know, just clumsy. The ex-Soviet Union is not a place for dyspraxics. Victory Park's name comes from the Soviet Union's victory in World War II, because what else could it be, and was opened in November 1950. There is also here a memorial to the Afghanistan War of 1979-89, which is something you don't see in Peel Park or Queen's Park. Victory Park itself is, I mean, I'm going to say it's quite big. It's not quite big, but it feels big. It's apparently 34 hectares, which, you know, I've no idea what 34 hectares is, but it's 34 hectares. If you know what 34 hectares is, you've got a visualisation of it. It covers much of the top of the big cliff that dominates the northern vista of Yerevan. Although the town is built on an incline, that last section that includes the Cascades is much steeper than the rest of the city. It's got a series of wide straight paths lined with trees and, there used to be a statue of Stalin here, because, obviously. It was then removed in 1962, because, again, obviously. In fact, it's surprising it took that long. Apparently one person was killed during its removal, which means that even after death, Stalin was a murderer. What replaced it a few years later is the Mother Armenia statue. This is huge, standing at 22 metres tall, and the whole edifice itself is 51 metres. The pedestal, the same as the one that, you know, Stalin was on top of, is made of basalt and is a cuboid block constructed to look like an Armenian church. Does it look like an Armenian church? I've no idea, I'm not convinced, but then I'm not overly knowledgeable about such things. Anyway, Mother Armenia herself, apparently modelled by a 17-year-old girl, clearly not a mother, stands facing over the city. She's wearing what feels like a long robe or dress that hits the floor. In her hands, she's holding a huge sword, which is absolutely not a euphemism, with the hilt in her right hand and supporting the blade in her left. At her feet is a shield. It very definitely has a militaristic vibe. It's also much easier to see than the Mother Georgia statue. Although it stands on the edge of a cliff, there's much more space around it to wander and view it at all angles. In addition, the rest of the park is quite flat, so you can see it in good position from quite a wide area. Bonus points for the fact you can even go in it. Or at least you can go into the pedestal. It's been a military museum since it was built, though its thematics have changed over time. What was once a museum dedicated to how Soviet Armenia performed in the Great Patriotic War, in keeping with the theme of Victory Park itself, it's now a museum on Armenian military history, with a specific exhibition concentrating on the wars in Artsakh, which is a whole nother issue. Back when I first thought about coming to this region, about 10 years ago, Artsakh, better known in the West as Nagorno-Karabakh, was one of my places to visit, because, well, you know my feelings on unrecognised nation-states. Sadly, this was not possible on my visit, since a couple of months before my arrival, it had ceased to exist after an assault by Azerbaijan. It's all Stalin's fault, alongside a general commitment to formalise easily and frequently changed previously internal borders in a post-internal world. But you know what I think of borders. Anyway, the militarian history of the statue and the museum is evident in the open area around the statue. Normally, you'd expect, I don't know, statues of military leaders or symbolic representations of battles or something. No, or possibly yes. In a continuation of the Soviet vibe of this place, around the plinth of the statue stands some military hardware, including a tank, an anti-aircraft gun, and a small fighter plane. Obviously. Victory Park doesn't just contain military memorabilia and wide street pathways, though. Just a short slide from Mother Armenia is a fairground. It's not a big fairground, but it is a permanent structure, as in it's not like most small UK fairgrounds that are basically pop-ups and which you can often see being transported piecemeal on the motorways. Fairgrounds seem quite a common feature in ex-Soviet towns. For instance, I'm pretty sure I saw a small one in a park in both Minsk and Tiraspol. This fairground had dodgem cars, small rides, a Ferris wheel, and snack stalls. What it did not have was any people. Whether because it was out of season or not, I don't know, but it felt not just closed, but abandoned. The rides were stationary, the gates unlocked and wide open, the ticket booths and sweet stalls shuttered up. I casually wandered into the dodgem area, no one was there to stop me, and looked at the cars, no people around to scream in joy as the bright and colourful vehicles didn't collide with each other. There was even a boating lake with a very shallow water level, and no boats. A couple of old men sat on benches around it, gazing into their navels. A worn-out sign, well, more of a billboard in size, proclaimed that a dinosaur section was, quote, coming soon, unquote, though with no indication of when. The whole place felt like the bastard child of Pripyat and Tiraspol, the wheel much smaller than in the former, but still vibing bright yellow against the clear blue sky, and just as busy. Now, I've been mentioning quite a bit thus far in this pod about the generic Soviet ambience of Yerevan, and how it felt different in that regard to Baku and Tbilisi. In fact, if Baku feels like a cross between Birmingham and Dubai, and Tbilisi feels like Ankh Morpork, Yerevan feels like... feels like Minsk. It feels like Novosibirsk. It feels like Tiraspol. It feels exactly as you'd expect a typical Soviet city to feel. In one sense, this is surprising. Yerevan as a city has existed since a couple of decades before Rome. However, one very interesting difference, and possibly an unexpected one, is that Yerevan doesn't have an old town in the same sense as the other two cities. You might think this is because here, unlike in the other cities, Soviet planners pulled it all down to build modernist and utilitarian structures that made sense in their environment. And indeed, that's exactly what they did, starting not long after invading in the early 1920s. The other major difference, though, is, despite its age, Yerevan was never actually that big. It had a population around 50,000 in 1916, whereas at the same time Tbilisi's was 345,000 and Baku's was about 260,000. What also hadn't helped Yerevan was being in an earthquake zone. A devastating earthquake destroyed much of the contemporary city in 1679, and what was rebuilt then was on a much smaller scale. So when the Soviets did come in, they had much more of a blank canvas to work with. There is an area with a small, older town vibe, though. This is the Kond Historic District. It's just to the west of the city centre, and if you look at it on a map, it appears to be a huge dead end cut off from the rest of the city. And indeed, inside it, it does have very much that town within a town separated vibe. Its name comes from being at a nearby hill, and in fact, access from any other direction than north is pretty tricky because of this. It's an odd place, with narrow streets only a few feet wide which curl around the area without signs or pavements. Unstructured buildings that feel like they've been built by just piling stone up in a manner purely to ensure that it won't fall down. And random street art on the otherwise plain yellowish walls that would otherwise all look alike. It's the sort of place it would be very easy to get lost, even with a map, since very little is named. And it's unclear if the road on the right on the map is the road on the right in front of you, because it doesn't look like it's big enough to count. And yet, there's a car coming at you from it. It has the feel of a very quiet shanty town, even though it clearly isn't. It's the sort of place you'd expect to be cleared by modern developers. And indeed, there's a fancy hotel newly built at the only road entrance to the district. This is apparently the first building of a very long-standing plan to renovate and modernise the whole quarter, which has been on the card since the mid-80s and still hasn't happened. So who knows? As you are no doubt aware, Armenia claims the title of the first and oldest country to take Christianity as its official state religion, defined as being in 301 AD. There's a couple of older claimants, but none of them exist as independent states anymore. And of course, reliable sources back that far are rarer than the way my ex-French ex-fiancé liked her steak. There's a reason Jerusalem has an Armenian quarter as one of its four parts of its old town. In addition, as you might also expect, the dominant sect in the country isn't Catholicism, or Protestantism, nor even Eastern Orthodox. The Great Schism of 1054 passed them by as other people's problems, never mind the role of Martin Luther. Rather, according to the 2022 sentence, the dominant religion in the country is, specifically, the Armenian Apostolic Church, which accounts for a whopping 95.2% of the population. No other religion breaks even 0.6%, Catholicism, although no religion hit the dizzy heights of 2.2%. Bit of a bummer when you're surrounded on three sides by majority Islamic countries, even if two of them are officially secular. Spoiler alert. They actually get on reasonably well with the one that isn't. Certainly better than with the two that are. There are reasons for that. We'll come on to that later. Now, the main centre of the Armenian Church is the Cathedral of St. Gregory the Illuminator. This is the largest Armenian apostolic cathedral in the world, though I can't imagine there's much competition for that honour. Indeed, there are, again according to Wikipedia, precisely three Armenian apostolic churches in the UK. Two of them are in Kensington in London, and one of them, the Holy Trinity, very Armenian name, a mile or so south of Manchester city centre, opposite the Royal Infirmary near the university, which I've walked past, but disappointingly, never noticed. Anyway, St. Gregory the Illuminator, the cathedral, was built in the late 1990s, surprisingly late, but we can blame the Soviets and their atheism for that. It was consecrated in September 2001, apparently. Interestingly, in time for the 1700th anniversary of the proclamation of the Christianity in Armenia. I'm sure that would have made front page news, but it's possible we may have been distracted at the time by other things. Now, you can't take pictures inside. I don't honestly think anyone would have noticed if I had, but you know, it's the principle of the thing. So I made detailed notes on what it looked like at the time. I'm aware I rarely do this, and I should very much do it more. Also note, some people online have described it as underwhelming. I have no opinion on this. All I will say is that it's certainly not as ornate as, say, the co-cathedral in Valletta in Catholic Malta. Walking in, it's a very wide vestibule with a shrine in the centre. Everything is light grey stone, smooth stone, and smells faintly of incense. The shrine is four columns with a roof, decorated ornately with figures. As it turns out, it's the most ornate thing in the building. And the bottom of the shrine, inside it, is kind of like a well. People either walk past and touch the columns, or they prostrate themselves in front of the well. The main area opens out into a kind of rounded arrowhead shape. It's very wide, spacious, and open plan, with several sectors of pews with taffeta coverings. There are pews also at the back in the ends of the arrowhead. In the centre of the space is the altar, layered with candles, and two towers either side of a large central icon. The icon is full length, and as far as my religious knowledge goes, shows a seated Mary holding a toddler Jesus. This is an assumption rather than a statement of fact. Nearby are stone tablets on the wall depicting people. I'm assuming saints. I don't know. It's written in the Armenian alphabet. Also, either side of the altar are two thin, tall panels of stained glass. Indeed, though the space is big, the light seems to mainly come from the fact that the walls are quite pale. There are windows, but not many, and again, they're long and they're thin. There are, however, many candelabra, and the ceiling is very, very high. The walls are pretty much unadorned, being simply the stone and the candles. These candles are usually, but not always, six abreast, three either side of a raised cross. I say candles. They're candle effect light bulbs, but they do look very candly. On the outside, it's set back from the main roads, slightly up an embankment, so on one side there's a wide pathway running slightly below it, and from the main road heading south there's a long tiered staircase leading to the front door, well, leading to the outdoor patio that's quite wide, expansive and laden with large concrete paving stones. There's a view from it, but it's not exactly impressive. Obviously you can see Mount Ararat, but you can see that from a lot of the city, and anyway, that's a view better from the Cascades or Victory Park, because it's just so much higher. Now, according to the 2022 census, there are 515 Muslims in Armenia. This is a quarter of the number of pagans, but still 2.5 times the number of Jews. It is not for me to comment on any of that. By proportion of population, there are twice as many asexuals in the UK. But anyway, it may surprise you to know that Armenia has mosques. Well, one mosque. It's in Yerevan, in the south of the city centre, and opposite a market, which honestly gets more footfall. I'm convinced over half the people in the mosque complex on my visit were other tourists, and it was still pretty quiet. This is known as the Blue Mosque. It's not very big, and is a nice quiet space next to the busy road. I would say flippantly that it's not actually blue, but I'm sure you all know that blue is a very common colour for decoration in Central Asia, much of which is Islamic, so it's blue in the same way that the UK flag is. It's around 7,000 square metres in total area, and laid out around a rectangle of garden and pathways where you can just sit and ponder. Around the sides are rooms, some of which hold exhibits on carpets, pottery, and old pictures of the mosque before and during renovations. The entrance to these rooms is through brick archways. There's 24 of them around all four sides of the garden. There is, of course, a dome and a minaret, which stands at the gentle height of 24 metres, much smaller than, say, the anniversary of Soviet Armenia monument, because priorities. It was built in the 1760s. And it survived the Soviet era because it was turned into a museum. Otherwise, it might as well have just become site of another tenement block. It is of Iranian heritage, much to the annoyance of the Azerbaijanis, who claim it as their own. Indeed, it's run in conjunction with the city of Isfahan in neighbouring Iran, a little proof that Armenia and Iran seem to be on pretty good terms, which may surprise you. But then I guess the Iranians haven't tried to obliterate the country or its people in the last 120 years. And the border between the two is, as far as I'm aware, open. I wouldn't know. It's logistically awkward for a British passport holder to go there. Speaking of religion, the north of Armenia has a number of ancient monasteries and churches. The one surviving tour that I'd booked, that went from Yerevan to Tbilisi, visited three of them along its way north. Indeed, that's the focus of the trip, and it ends in Tbilisi, largely serendipitously. The tour was only able to take place because two other people had booked on it, a retired chap from Canada, some years older than me, and his Thai girlfriend, who was, within a month, my age. Much of the trip was him taking Instagrammy photos of her in the wilds, which, fair, why not? The road there was quite long and mostly scenic. The first half of the journey was mostly along wide but very bendy roads through snow-covered mountains. This is in the vicinity of the Gegem range, which additionally contains a few volcanoes, including the highest, Ajdahag, which is about 3,600 metres tall, and isn't too far from Mount Aragats, which I mentioned earlier, and I mention it because it's the highest mountain in Armenia, at just under 4,100 metres. I'm sure in summer this would make good hiking territory. On this trip, though, everything was white rather than green. The second half of the journey was through the Debed Canyon. Here, the landscape, though still hilly, wasn't as high and the mountains were definitely glinting more with green and yellow. The road and railway, the same one as I'd slept on for the journey south, generally ran alongside the river in a narrow valley bounded by steep sides. The river, incidentally, flows north and a couple of junctions later joins up with the Kura River in the very far west of Azerbaijan. That's the river that runs through Tbilisi. While on the face of it this area is quite pretty, it needs to be pointed out that this is an area very rich in copper, so many towns and villages along the canyon were set up by the Soviets in order to take advantage of this fact. So there's lots of factories, operational and ruinous. Set your expectations accordingly. One of the towns has a dead cable car structure in it going over the river, and presumably up to one of the factories on the opposite bank. Now it just sits idly over the water, waiting for a whistle that will never come. The monasteries of northern Armenia are mostly located around the Debed Canyon area, or rather, on the hilltops above the canyon, commanding quite awesome views, let's be honest. And it also made them all feel really peaceful. There wasn't a lot of external noise here other than the breeze. While located in villages, those villages are all pretty small. That said, given that they're UNESCO World Heritage Sites, I'd imagine in the height of summer they'd be much busier with tourists. Indeed, the first two we visited are linked by a long-distance waymarked footpath through the whole country. The first was Sanahin, which was in a village that for some reason reminded me of some of the very small places I'd been to in China 2 decades previously, and I can't really explain why. Something about the combination of it existing just around a road junction, the roads themselves being partly rutted and broken stone, the quietness and the chilly mountain air, and the couple of flags fluttering in the breeze. Associations are weird. Anyway, this monastery is just above the village, a short uphill amble. It was built in the 10th century, and its name means something along the lines of "this one is older than that one," for reasons that I'll come on to when I talk about Hagbat, the "that one" referred to in the phrase. There's several buildings, or at least rooms, in the complex, most of them connected. From the outside, they're cuboid, with short, rounded, pointed towers and with entrances laden with rounded arches. The whole thing is made from stone, basalt, apparently, which gives it a slightly dark, foreboding vibe. Inside, the floors are made from stone slabs. I mean, most of them are graves, and you can see the inscriptions and designs on them, not quite faded yet. The arches continue inside, so the passageways between the rooms are open and wide. At the centre is the churchy bit, with a very high ceiling, wooden benches, and a raised stone platform that serves as the place the service is led from. From the ceiling is a large 3-tiered silver chandelier, ornately decorated with candles, or again, at least these days, candle light bulbs. There was, as far as I could see, only one piece of religious iconography, a painting of Mary and Child, I assume. It's in the very centre, and it's the only thing of colour in the complex. It's mostly blue. Well, I mean, the pattern is repeated in one of the smaller chapels to the side, but the point stands. Behind the monastery are the remains of additional later buildings, and a small graveyard. I believe it's still actively used as such, and there's a few modern houses just a short way behind them. Hagbad Monastery lies on the other side of the canyon, not that far in a straight line. Indeed, I think you can see one from the other in theory, but it's a bit of a trek by road. My understanding of the folkloric connection between here and Sanahin is that Sanahin was built first by a master architect, then Hagbad was built by his apprentice who wanted to build something that rivaled it in size and impact, and so to differentiate and promote the original, the name Sanahin was coined. Historically, they were both originally founded at similar times, so it's easy to see how much a tale would form. And maybe it's true. Who knows? Rather than being set above the village, the monastery here is kind of at the end of it, where the housing would otherwise fall over the edge of the cliff. Because of this, it feels a bit more open than Sanahin in layout. That one feels a bit more hemmed in, like a liquid in a box. Whereas this one, or is it technically the other one, has the sense of being allowed to expand to fill the space left for it, like a gas. Inside, the complex has similar vibes, being largely stone, arched, and with large ceilings. The main cathedral centre here also has arranged stone plinths, but here behind it is a large mural of, I mean, I assume it's Jesus, but I've never been terribly good with faces. Below are faded murals of saints and important people standing in rows. Two things to notice about the buildings here. One is the frequency of holes in the floor. These are purposefully built and serve as ways to access the basement, which was used primarily as a larder and a storage facility. This is quite a common thing in these old monastery buildings. I'll be mentioning them again later. The other is that one of the rooms has fabulous acoustics. The Canadian took his time singing in it, and it resonated well regardless of where in the room I was standing. The complex also has several side chapels and other buildings which are smaller but no less impressive, both in setting and in style. One is shaped a bit like a square with the corners chopped off, ornate windows high on each side, and in the middle a small tower on columns that rises to a point, obviously with a cross on top. Many of the structures in both complexes had a hole in the roof and a corresponding hole in the floor to allow rain to fall in and pass right through. Presumably snow too. One thing I will say about that is that the temperature differential between the inside and the outside was quite noticeable, even for February. The last of the three monasteries we visited was Achtala, which is translated as White Glade. It's also known by a name that I'm not even going to attempt to pronounce correctly, but it's something along the lines of Pinzazank, which translates as copper mine, and it's much more accurate in the modern era. Historically, this acted more as a fortress than a dedicated religious centre, although it did both. Again, it's located at the edge of a hill at the end of a village, but it feels more, I guess, more like a dedicated space, like this is where the road goes, this is the end goal, this is a wide area, we're going to build something. Rather than the other monasteries, which felt more like, let's stick a building here, oh, it's expanded. It, like the other monasteries, was probably originally constructed sometime in the late 10th century. And on that note, the first thing to notice that definitely sets it apart from the other two is that entering the complex is done through a large gate flanked by stone towers. It's the only easy access to the site, unless you fancy some sheer rock climbing, so it's very clear this place was built to be defended. Inside the door is a wide open grassy area with the foundations of previous buildings visible. These again include storage facilities and wine cellars, and there's any number of holes in the ground that would have led to underground passageways and larders, which are very easy to fall into if you're not looking where you're going. They're not fenced off or anything, obviously. The biggest of the surviving buildings is the Holy Mother of God Church. It is, apparently, a domed basilica, inside of which are three aisles, a very tall ceiling, and an awful lot of murals, dating from the early 13th century, and they are now all quite faded. They're typical religious artwork depicting Bible stories and tales of subsequent saints. Definitely not what you'd find in the Cathedral of St. Gregory the Illuminator, and shows a much more Byzantine influence to church decoration. One of the more notable modern aspects to this complex is the prevalence of Artsakh flags. If you've never seen it before, the flag of Artsakh was the same basic design as the Armenian flag, which is red, blue and orange stripes, but with the addition of... Wikipedia says it's a five-toothed stepped white carpet pattern. I say it's reminiscent of an 8-bit video game chevron. Either way, it's not a flag you see very often, and given the dissolution of the state at the start of the year, you probably won't see it very often again. It was a pain in the bum to photograph too, since I had to wait for the wind to catch it just right. Plus, it appeared that these flags only had the chevron on one side. Quite why the flag of Artsakh was so prevalent here, I didn't really work out at the time, other than, you know, solidarity. On the way in, there were memorials to some who'd fought there, and a suggestion that there was some cross-collaboration and funding for maintenance given by Artsakh, so I'm guessing it was something to do with that? I don't know. It would be remiss of me to keep mentioning in passing the beef Armenia has with Azerbaijan and Turkey without going into the detailed backstory behind it. Now, obviously, on a casual and happy travel-themed podcast such as this, I can only give the very basicest of overviews, and if you want some much deeper analysis, there are many specialists you can turn to. In a nutshell, the Armenian people lived a wide area of the southern Caucasus and what is now eastern Turkey. They were dominated by two empires. Eastern Armenia was under Russian control and influence, while Western Armenia was controlled by the Ottoman Empire. Estimates are that around 2 million Armenians lived within the boundaries of the Ottoman Empire, which, by the end of the 19th century, it was pretty much on its last legs. Independence movements and wars in the Balkans, where else, in the early 1910s, were further damaging its prestige and power, and they feared the loss of their eastern provinces too, especially when Armenians themselves began to demand it, and also especially because at the time the Ottoman Empire was strongly Islamic, and of course the Armenians are infidel Christians. So, possibly to distract itself from the battles they were having in the West in World War I, they launched a preemptive strike on the Armenian people and cause. April 24, 1915, which was later commemorated as Armenian Genocide Remembrance Day, was the date of what's considered to be the first act of the subsequent genocide, when many leading members of the Armenian intelligentsia, about 250 it's estimated, were arrested in Constantinople and... I mean, most of them were eventually murdered, but in between there was a period of time in concentration camps. Now, if that had been the only act, it would have been a typical act of a despotic government, but as you probably know, it was not. Over the course of the next few years, pretty much every single one of those 2 million Armenians was forcibly moved or fled the country. It's estimated around 1 million ended up on death marches into the deserts in the southeast, where they were left to the mercy of conditions and the soldiers guarding them, with inevitable results. Many of those who survived, notably the women and children, only did so having been taken by soldiers and forced to become part of their family. In the decades afterwards, they lost their Armenian heritage, while relatives in Soviet Armenia attempted to trace them. Most of the others died in concentration camps, or just while on the road getting there, by natural or unnatural causes. The bulk of the deportations and casual exterminations ended by the start of 1918, but to be honest, there were still crackdowns and disappearances of Armenians in what soon after became Turkey, until at least the start of the 1930s. Of the 2 million Armenians present at the start, there were maybe a couple of hundred thousand in Istanbul by the end. In the rest of the country, Armenian presence was literally wiped out. As an aside, one of the long-run Turkish desires was to create a pan-Turkic state that stretched more or less from Istanbul to Baku. The Azerbaijanis are a very closely related people with a mutually comprehensive language and a very similar culture. And this is, of course, partly why Armenia and Azerbaijan don't have any sort of relations and why places like Artsakh are such a flashpoint. An Armenian majority area in a Turkic Azerbaijan is the sort of situation that brings to mind events 100 years previously. It's interesting that the Armenian Genocide has been considered seminal in genocide definitions. When the Holocaust, and specifically the Shoah, of World War II was being resolved, which feels like a weird word to use for it, leading lawyers used the Armenian Genocide as a reference frame to define it and created international laws aimed at criminalising the Holocaust precisely because they looked at the Armenian Genocide and tried to work out why, apart from a casual trial more for show in 1920, which led to precisely 3 death penalties, no one had ever really been actually charged with any crime. It's also interesting that the Nazis themselves looked at the Armenian Genocide and directly thought, yeah, we can do this. Adolf Hitler himself stated in 1939, who, after all, speaks today of the annihilation of the Armenians in defence of his plans for Eastern Europe? The Armenian Genocide itself is commemorated in Yerevan in a museum complex just to the west of the city centre. It's called by a name that translates to Swallow Fortress, Tsitsernakabird, I'm going to try and pronounce it as. It's the original name of the area it stands in. Apparently, it's an Iron Age hill fort. It's not that easy place to find. The most direct way is along a road past the disused football stadium, and then a turn to the right just past it along a vague service road into what for all the world looks like they're going to build an industrial or commercial park. Coming from the other direction, which is what I did on the way there because that's what Google Maps told me to do, had me walk a large loop north in the grey suburbs, then past a large purpose-built sports and concert arena before walking through a large area of paths and small trees. This is all apparently on purpose. The story goes that when the genocide memorial was built in 1967 by the Soviets, it was done only after a large amount of internal pressure, and they built it a little grudgingly. So after they built it, they hid it from view, so to speak, by its location and the construction of the sports arena between it and the main road, so you wouldn't actually see it. The memorial complex itself is, I think the best word is understated. If you come in from past the sports centre, the first thing you reach is a copse of trees planted by foreign dignitaries to commemorate the genocide, including presidents and popes. The UK is represented by a member of the House of Lords who I'd never heard of. which maybe tells you something. There's kind of haunting ethereal Armenian singing as background noise as you walk through this section. The main body of the site is made up of four sections, built on a rectangular area of grass at the edge of a hill. At the far end of the site is a circular zone with an eternal flame centred within, built slightly below ground level. It's specifically 1.5 metres below, because 1.5 million people are said to have died, and covered by 12 inclined stone panels reaching quite high above and forming a kind of truncated cone. The purpose behind this is to give the visitor the natural inclination to bow forward slightly in respect as they walk down the stairs into it. That there are 12 stone panels is symbolic. 12 provinces considered to be Armenian are now part of Turkey. Just outside the eternal flame is a tall, thin tower. It's 44 metres tall, and sadly I can't find any symbolic representation for this number, but it represents hope and the future of Armenians, in a sense their rebirth and how they are now, despite everything else, standing tall. Alongside one of the paths leading from the copse to the eternal flame is a 100-metre stone wall, inscribed with the names of Ottoman towns cleansed of Armenians, places where the genocide happened and which are now in the provinces controlled by Turkey. If you think about it, it makes for a quite a long list. Underneath the whole site is a small museum which goes into great depth about the genocide, from the causes all the way to its aftermath and subsequent similar events worldwide. There's, what, about 67 different information panels, each of which has objects and items on display associated with it. Info is in four languages. None of them is Turkish. There is an Armenian restaurant in the centre of Manchester, opposite Albert Square and the building site that currently passes for the town hall. I walk past it often, but I've never been in it, because I rarely go to restaurants. It's not my niche. However, I appreciate that it's there, even if I'm a little confused as to why it's there. If it means Manchester has a significant Armenian diaspora, then hey, that makes it easier for me to change my £20 worth of dram, which is an otherwise almost completely worthless and inconvertible currency. But I'm not 100% convinced. Anyway, my experience of Armenia itself, I'd posit, whisper it quietly, Armenian food isn't quite as notable as Georgian food. Honestly, I was hard pushed to tell the difference. Now, granted, my experience of Armenian food domestically was limited to pubs that sell meals rather than, you know, restaurants. But I mean, you get a good feel of UK food if you spend all your time and money in Wetherspoons. And before anyone comes out with comments about the quality of food in Wetherspoons, A, I know, and B, honestly, there's a reason English restaurants aren't a thing in the rest of the world. It is, as they say, hard to polish a turd. But anyway, I went to eat and drink at a couple of places in central Yerevan. First up was somewhere called 379, or 379 Torch and Brew, to give it its full name. It's a place kind of just behind the main Republic Square, and it's underground, or at least the bit I accessed was down some steps and into a large, if slightly plain, room, though other bits of it had a more fancy aesthetic. The menu was quite extensive and big, an A4-sized document with full-page pictures of examples of what to expect. I had a small buffet combo plate with all manner of foods on it, and it was bigger than I was expecting, albeit maybe with an over-reliance on small prawns. There were two entire piles of them, and one of them would have been enough. It also came with garlic bread. Now, garlic bread here is not like garlic bread of what I'm used to. Whenever I think of garlic bread, I think either of one side of a baguette smothered in garlic butter or a pizza-shaped blob covered with garlic. Here, garlic bread is generally small cuboids of black bread, slightly longer than the width of my mobile phone, grainy, somewhat crisp, and laden with garlic shavings. But then I guess kachapuri exists, so garlic bread probably doesn't need to resemble what we've got in the UK. 379 Torch and Brew is, as you can tell from the name, also a brew pub, and I had three of their beers, a Pilsner, a dark lager, and an American wheat beer. They were nice, if nothing out of the ordinary, decent enough and would happily drink again, but not ones I'd necessarily actively seek out. My second night saw me visit the Klikia Brew House, pretty much in the centre of the city. It was quite odd at first, since it's both a restaurant and a gastropub, and I went in the restaurant entrance, which I think was actually closed. It took a few seconds for anyone to notice I was there, and then they were confused as to why I was there, but it was all quickly sorted out. And when I left, the easiest exit was through to a side road rather than one on the main road. Anyway, again, the place I needed to be was downstairs. There's a theme developing here. Here, I had a beef cacciapuri. This was your normal bread cheese teardrop, but this time topped with little chunks of very salty beef, which added a nice texture. And I managed to eat it all in one sitting for the first time, which might be an achievement, but I'd walked a lot that day and I'd not eaten anywhere near as much as I should have done. So I'm going to assume mitigating circumstances. Again, this is another place that brews its own beer. Theirs, however, was more traditionally lager in style, and I've never been fond of lagers. I had an unfiltered lager, a pale, and a Munich dark lager. The unfiltered was, for me anyway, the best of the lot. It had a weird yeasty aftertaste. I appreciated it, but others may not. The other two beers, kind of just fairly standard average lagers, really. On my last night in Yerevan, I went to the craft beer bar close to the hostel, and which I'd walked past quite a few times. This is the Darget craft beer brew pub. It's Thursday, isn't it? The name gives away that this was another place that brews its own beer. Indeed, in the basement, you can sit amongst the brewing tuns and barrels. For once, though, I sat at ground level. They had a lot of beers to choose from, and they had predefined flights of five of their beers, so I took advantage and had some beer. It wasn't cheap. The drinks worked out between about £4.45 and £5.57 a pint, but to be fair, the equivalent would have been a couple of quid more, even in Manchester. My notes suggest that this was the best beer I had in Yerevan and included a couple of decent dark beers, a fruit beer that tasted of apricot, a bready lager, and a couple of pale ales. While there, I also had food, that Central Asian speciality of poutine. I did go to one other bar. The other side of the hostel, but not too far away, was a place called Beer Point, which was an underground place, because of course it was, that played rock music, and served mainly beers from a brewery in East Anglia, which, yeah, I was confused as well. Like, above the bar was a whole shelf of stacked empty beer bottles, and they were all from Woodford's. I did not ask why, I just accepted it. Their available beer selection on tap was smaller than it looked. On my visit, several of the pumps weren't working, and because I wanted local beer, my selection was limited even further. I ended up only having two here, a Darget Pilsner on tap, which was, and a bottle of pale ale from a small Yerevan brewery called Beer Geek that was actually pretty good. I had wanted to visit another bar local to my hostel, for no reason other than it was called The Beatles Pub, but it was closed. It being underground meant that it was undergoing renovations due to a leak in the business above it. I realised that was more about beer than food, but you all know me well enough by now to know that I do beer more than I do food. I will say that on the tour that I did on the last day, our first stopping point was a bakery in the small town of Aparan, in the little way north of Yerevan, in the foothills of the mountains. Calling it a bakery is both accurate and a disservice. This was not a Greggs. Rather, this had the vibe of an entire food court area with many different stalls where you could buy all manner of baked and bready goods. And in addition, there were places where you could actually see people kneading the dough. The tour paid for a small, simple but filling bready item, but I was hungry, so I bought myself another. I don't really know how to describe it, other than it was a sausage built into a cheesy, bready turnover thing. Because, obviously... Also on the tour, we, including our guide and the driver, had home-cooked lunch in someone's house close to the monastery at Hagbat. She provided a small banquet-type affair with a host of roasted vegetables and salads and breads, as well as an awful lot of roasted chicken. That she lived with an entire chicken coop in the garden is probably of no relevance. I mean, there were also about seven cats in the house. It was quite similar in style to the one I'd had in Georgia on the way back from Upolishtika, but obviously well, this was far fewer of us, so it was much smaller in scope. And didn't last as long. I will say too that in neither instance did the people living there actually sit with us. They stayed elsewhere in the house while we ate. The only contact was the occasions they brought over more food. Maybe that felt a bit odd. Not quite sure, to be honest. So, having breezed through the Armenia-Georgia border with nary an issue, not needing my Unwood ticket, which I had well to hand, the tour dumped me at the Envoy Hostel in Tbilisi, a place I'd unknowingly walked past on my explorations through the old town. It's near the bottom of a very steep hill on a cobblestone road that goes very close to one of the important squares, Maiden Square. Even though I wasn't staying there that night because I'd been on the tour and stayed at the Yerevan branch, I was allowed to lurk in the common room of the hostel while I waited for time to pass before my flight. I mean, my flight was at 5 a.m. and I arrived about 7 p.m, so it wasn't like I was rushed. That said, while I popped to a nearby mini supermarket for some nibbles, I was conscious that it made sense to take a bus to the airport rather than a taxi. Off-season, lest we not forget, so I had no guarantee that even though I was in a hostel full of backpackers, that any of them would be catching a morning flight on that day. Or, in fact, that it was full of backpackers, which it wasn't. Though there were nearer spots to catch the bus from, including back at Ayla Bari, the metro station nearest the hotel I stayed in when I was last here, I decided I'd be better served walking to the stop at Liberty Square because I knew it was going to be busy and other people would be catching it. It was one of those thought processes of, I don't want to be stuck there alone. The last bus was something like 11 p.m. and I was there not long after 10, so I knew there wouldn't be an issue, but nevertheless, I wanted to make sure. And I took the view I'd rather wait at the airport, having spent one lari, than wait in the hostel and get a taxi. Did actually catch the bus quite fine, and it was actually quite busy, albeit slightly overpopulated with tipsy men, one of whom fell over on the exit at one of the intervening stops, but don't worry, he was fine. On this journey, I had my back to the screen that detailed the journey, but it was pretty easy to tell when we were getting close to the airport, even in the dark. The wait in the airport was about as exciting as you'd imagine, and I spent much of the time going through my podcast backlog. At one point, the seat next to me was occupied by a random dog who wandered in and sat down without a care in the world, but I guess that was better than someone who was actively trying to talk to me. Once through check-in, I still had 3 hours to waste. Some of that was spent buying a Wendy's, which I don't think I've ever eaten at Wendy's before. It's an American fast food joint that, unlike Burger King and McDonald's, hasn't really made it to the UK. Obviously, being an airport, it was more expensive than it ought to have been, but I was hungry, and I knew the food on the planes was going to be non-existent. The only point of note was that my flight was advertised as being delayed by 25 minutes. This isn't a lot, and is only really notable because it was displayed thus on my arrival at the airport, which was before the inbound flight had even left Munich. I think that's what you call hedging your bets. The flights themselves were fine. I slept, surprisingly, on the flight to Munich, despite it being a middle seat. Guess that's how tired I was. The other flight into Manchester passed without an issue at all, to the extent that I don't even remember it, and I got back home without any problem by tram. This was unlike the last time I arrived in Manchester Airport, which I mentioned in a recent podcast, and that was just as well. So what would I say my impressions of Armenia were? Obviously, of the three countries I visited on this trip, it's the one I saw the most of, in a sense, or at least the one I visited places furthest out from the capital, so it gave me more of an impression of the country as a whole. It definitely, as I've said, vibed as the most Soviet, and that was something I felt in the rest of the country too, even if to a smaller extent. Many of the towns we passed through were ones which the Soviets had built up around industries, for example, copper along the Debed Canyon, sugar and dairy in Spitak, where we stopped for a rest break. Spitak and its neighbourhood is quite interesting, as the factories were huge, but also now derelict, so the road runs for probably not far shy of a kilometre along a fence, beyond which is the remains of one of the main factories that gave the town its primary raison d'etre. A bit like Ashfield. With the added problem that this was the epicentre of the Armenian earthquake in December 1988, which I recall vaguely being reported on, which pretty much destroyed the entire town. This was the back end of the Soviet era too, so the future wasn't that bright for Spitak. It's been rebuilt and all, but one can't help but feel it didn't get the best power-ups in the game of life. I'd probably be interested in going back in non-wintry conditions, as the mountains did look pretty sweet. Plus, of course, there's a whole nother range of them in the far south. I didn't have too much trouble communicating. Certainly the staff in the bars, etc. spoke enough English for me to get by, and in shops and street stores the prices of things were clearly labelled, so I had no issues trying to remember what Armenian was for 1537. I didn't have a strong as impression that Russian would be as functional as a lingua franca, but if nothing else, there's a good chance most of the population would know it, so in the long run it'd be more useful than English. As an aside, what was interesting at the monasteries, there were information boards present, including 5 in Armenian, English, Russian, Italian and French, but not in words. No, these were translated into Braille. You wouldn't get that at Salford Cathedral. With regards to presenting in a vaguely gender non-conforming way, note, as an aside, I no longer own a pair of non-jean trousers, since in Yerevan I finally decided that my cargo pants were a bit beyond repair, so in the bin they went. It had the added benefit of making my backpack slightly lighter and easier to carry. I don't really feel I had any issues with being NB. It's always quite hard for me to assess this, as while I know people might judge, I'm still apparently 1m91 tall or thereabouts, so therefore aren't exactly an easy target, even for proponents of traditional toxic masculinity. And my hair got positive vibes, like in Georgia. The best example of this was in a small museum inside the Mother Armenia statue, which was being looked after by two late middle-aged women. Not quite the archetypal Russian babushkas, but certainly on that spectrum. Anyway, they pigeonholed me as I was leaving and demanded not that I donate to the museum, which was otherwise free entry, but that I have a selfie with them on the steps outside. Several selfies. Because of the purple hair. I mean, at least I assume it was because of the purple hair. We didn't really have much of a language in common. Another thing I'll say about gender presentation is, on my first day in Yerevan, after I checked in and I was just wandering around, one unusual thing I did do was go for a shave. Yep, I sought out a local barber-type shop and had human interaction in a foreign environment. Go me. The place was called Black Barber Shop on the Ring Road on the west side of the city centre. It was a pretty lush experience, was pampered with hot towels, fragrant oils and soft aftershave. And all for about £16, which, I mean, I've no idea if that's expensive or not. All I know is that, you know, when you've got a lot of inconvertible currency that I was no longer going to spend on hostel tours, why the heck not? I will say it did wonders for my gender dysphoria. I've grown to realise I definitely don't feel like me with excessive facial hair. A week's worth of stubble is just about fine, but any longer, when it starts to itch, when it starts to look obviously beardy, when I start to feel it's too obviously masculine, it has to come off. Normally this is 2 weeks, but the last couple of days are always pushing it, so trimmed or removed it has to be. Call it a transaction. Call that a really dreadful pun. But anyway, what didn't do wonders for my gender dysphoria was wearing a scrunchie to keep the hair away from my face and noticing how thin and weak the patches of hair are on the top of my head. A curse on male pattern baldness. If only there were ways around this. Listener, there are ways around this, but that's a whole different ball game. Or rather, like whist, a game without balls. Well, that's about all for this pod. Join me next time for another adventure beyond Russia. Until then, remember, Stalin was a dick, and if you're feeling off colour, keep on getting better. Thank you for listening to this episode of Travel Tales from Beyond the Brochure. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, don't forget to leave a review on your podcast site of choice. Travel Tales from Beyond the Brochure was written, presented, edited and produced in the Glasgow studio by the Barefoot Backpacker. The theme music is Walking Barefoot on Grass, Bonus by Kai Engel, which is available via the Free Music Archive and used under the Creative Commons Attribution 4.0 International License. Previous episodes are available on your podcast service of choice, and show notes are available on my website, barefoot-backpacker.com. If you want to contact me, tweet me at rtwbarefoot, email me at info@barefoot-backpacker.com, or look for me on Instagram, Discord, YouTube, or Facebook. Don't forget to sign up for my newsletter, and if you really like what I do, you can slip me the cost of a beer through my Patreon in return for access to rare extra content. Until next time, have safe journeys. Bye for now.